Let's bow our heads. Loving and mighty God, at this minute and this hour, let the words of my lips and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. O Lord, for you are our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. A couple of months ago, right before I had the privilege of speaking with you good people the last time, we passed the 25th anniversary of a significant cosmic event. Anybody remember what that is? Those are your two clues, 25 years and cosmic event. Was the 25th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope. Things have been sitting up there for a quarter of a century. It has given us glimpses into heaven like we've never had before. Look at this. I mean, this is real. This is not some artist's imagination. This is a photograph of creation itself. It's almost an ultrasound, you might say. This is the way that it worked. Edwin Hubble, the namesake for the telescope, was arguably the greatest cosmologist of the 20th century. Edwin Hubble is the one who discovered that the universe is expanding, always expanding. In fact, the day will come when some of the galaxies at the farthest reaches of our sight, and this is accelerating all the time, that they will be moving that way so fast, and we will be moving this way so fast, that the separation will exceed the speed of light, and those galaxies will disappear to our sight and we to theirs, never to be seen again. Galaxies will disappear. Now that bothers you. You can take solace from the fact that the expansion of the universe solves one great problem of Sir Isaac Newton's theory of gravity. If heavenly bodies are always being attracted to one another, then why doesn't the universe simply just collapse in on itself? It doesn't, because it is continually and observably expanding. You see the light get redder and redder as it moves away. I can't help but feel that Emanuel Swedenborg would have loved to have known this. Sure, his insights inform our church's somewhat unique theology, but he was first and perhaps foremost a man of science. He understood Newton's theories intimately. Newton's principles had been published just the year before Swedenborg was born. Swedenborg studied under some of Newton's associates in England, and he deftly used the mathematics of gravity in his many engineering designs. But we know that Swedenborg used observations of science and nature, which to him were one and the same, to extract truths about heaven. All living flora, for example, show us that the purpose of our life is not just to grow and to blossom, but ultimately to produce a good and useful fruit And for that, for us, that does not need reproduction. We don't need a biblical manual for that. So we sit here on Lion Street underneath these graceful tree trunks to remind us that this very building is the fruit of the people who came here before us, and to inspire us to meditate when we are here about what good and useful fruits we ourselves might be producing. So Swedenborg would have probably enjoyed this balance between Newton's gravity and Hubble's expansion. He would have seen it, methinks, as corresponding to the equilibrium we need to establish between love and wisdom, between what we know and understand and what we feel and what we do. We may have mountains of knowledge, but if that is not coupled with love, we have very little wisdom. Or we may feel infinite compassion, but if that is not tempered by prudence, we can make a royal mess of things. So how much do I know about Hubble's law? I can't really say that I know it. I like to think about it. It makes excellent grist for the mill. But I don't know it. Any one of you here today could change my mind completely in a couple of minutes conversation, you know, right when we leave from service here. And I feel that if you know something, you can never unknow it. Do I believe it? Well, that's essentially what I'm here to talk about today. Belief in the biblical sense. Jesus says, all things can be done for the one who believes. But as I have said here before, this word believe has changed since it was first used in English translation from the original Greek. The word pistuo, the Greek pistuo, was translated in Latin as credo, to give your heart, to be totally devoted, not opinor, to think, to have a strong opinion. The proper English word chosen to convey this give your heart meaning was believe, taken from the German verb belieben, which means essentially to hold something as beloved. Lieben is to love, belieben is to hold something as beloved. And I know you can easily see how belieben becomes belief. So in that sense, do I believe in Hubble's law? To be truthful, I enjoy playing in the astrophysics sandbox every now and then. But it really doesn't matter to me. I don't see how my life is changed by it. But the idea, the thought, has caused me to reflect on what we think, what we know, and what we believe. I met a person who's endured 5 years of health hell. By her count, she has seen 138 doctors in that 5 years, and none of them can diagnose what is wrong with her, why she is slowly dying. I listened to a long monologue, lasting half an hour at least, of her ordeal, only interrupting to ask clarifying questions. Was that what the doctor at the Mayo Clinic said? She needed to get it out, to hear it, and see if somehow, maybe this time, it would make sense to her. This time. And finally, she let out a sigh and revealed, "I can't help but feel that this is punishment for not treating my father kindly enough." Her estranged father had died while she was immersed in giving 24/7 care to her dying mother. She asked what she thought. She asked what I thought she should do. And being Swedenborgian and therefore believing, there's that word again, believing that as spiritual beings, we already exist in a shadowy form in the spiritual world, while we are distracted by the challenges of this physical world in which we exist, I said, "Well, if I was you, I would find some place to get myself really, really quiet and have a conversation with my father and ask for his forgiveness. And I would work on forgiving myself as well." "But I can't do that," she said. "I'm not worthy of his forgiveness." I said, "Well, that rather flies in the face of the concept of grace, doesn't it?" She said, "I don't know what you mean by that." I said, "Grace. That we are loved without earning it, or even, it seems to us, without even deserving it. Divine love is graciously given. As Paul said, God proves his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." "Well, I'm sorry," she said. I just don't believe that." There's that word again. And she didn't mean she didn't believe the Jesus story. We didn't really get into that. She didn't believe the grace thing. And so she's on the horns of a dilemma. She feels she has to earn her father's forgiveness, but thinks she cannot because he's gone. She has herself painted into a corner, doesn't she? And without being judgmental, I think we can see that she might be punishing herself. Possibly even to the extent of a mysterious deterioration of her physical health. I rather think that, but I don't pretend to be a psychiatrist. And again later, it sent me spiraling again into trying to discern the difference between what we know, what we think, and what we believe. And here is at least part of what I have come up with for myself. I know there is God. Or to be careful not to put off or offend anybody, I know there is divine. Even the word God can be provocative to some, limiting to others. So I will say divine and then ask you for your definition of that. I know there is divine. I know this instinctively and intuitively. I feel it to the very core and fiber of my being. It is in my DNA. And being in my DNA, I can't help but feel it must be in everybody's DNA. Now, I acknowledge that those who are skeptical or deny this may well have good reason. Lord knows that for all the good that religion has done, hospitals and schools and charity, for all that, also an awful lot of harm has been done in the name of God. Maybe someone was injured by a father figure and has no desire to ever have another one. Maybe God has meant to them an unholy list of rules and regulations and restrictions that has excluded and oppressed them. Maybe the stories just do not resonate with them. The stories are too angry or too violent to portray a loving, caring, forgiving God, which is what they need. We all have our stories. We have our storybook, our Holy Bible. We have the Holy Quran. And I wonder if this is the first time a Quran was ever shown from the pulpit in this church. I'm not worried about being struck by lightning. Manuel Swedenborg himself wrote that in the spiritual world, the Mohammedan heaven is right next to the Christian heaven. We have the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedas. We have the Tao Te Ching. All of these and many more. Written and telling, I would say, essentially the same story, but written, well, Reverend Lee has come in. Written, would you agree with this? Written not so much in different languages, but in different cultures. The cultures, the stories were shaped by the cultures in which they were first told, and have since shaped the cultures in which they've been repeated. So what about our stories? Do I believe the stories in our good book that originally all creation was very good until fallen, selfish man began to spoil it? That there was and is a price to pay for living contrary to the divine plan. That there has been redemption. That a perfect, all-loving, all-righteous, all-just man was destroyed by the evil world for the sin of his innocence. And yet, nevertheless, that goodness and truth ultimately can never be defeated. Do I believe these things? Well, I think so. And I'm not saying I think I believe them. I mean, these stories have been excellent grist for the mill. I've turned these stories over and over and tried to learn the essential lessons from them without much worry about the literal truth of them. I understand that they were written a long time ago in a style not very familiar to us today, and the meanings, as they have come through my thick skull, make sense to me. So I might as well say, I believe them, for I love them for having been the stepping stones to the things that I truly believe, the things to which I do give my heart, I will give my life. I believe there is a unity to all things, to all of this, to physical galaxies that disappear from us, and spiritual truths that cannot be objectively proven. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. All things are connected. I carry in my pocket at all times this little keychain from the Swedenborgian Church in Cincinnati. Who produced this? Anyone remember?
The chapel?
The
red cross on one side?
Yeah. Okay, in Cambridge.
Cambridge.
I thought this came from Cambridge. Oh, Cambridge, anyways.
Oh, the current source.
This is a collector's item. This is one of the old ones. Has Swedenborg's own words right on here. Nothing unconnected ever occurs. There is unity. In fact, anything unconnected could never come into existence. I believe this. I believe that within that unity, there is a certain harmony that vibrates throughout all creation. That harmony is peace itself, is joy itself, is hope itself, is love itself, is grace itself. I believe we need to resonate with that harmony and extend it. I believe the best thing that we can do in prayer is to ask to bring ourselves in tune with that harmony. We cannot ask without being disappointed for the laws of the unity of the universe to be altered to suit our desires. But when we come into harmony, seemingly miraculous things can and do occur. And then, as it said in Leviticus this morning, then shall our rains fall in their season, our fields yield their produce, our trees their fruit, then no sword shall go through our land. I believe that living in that harmony, we must treat the creation entrusted to us with reverence and respect. This is our responsibility. It is not whales that are poisoning our planet. It's not elephants or California condors. I will concede that cows, those comely methane generators, have their impact. But by whose hand are so many cows populating what once were oxygen-breathing rainforests? Our Bible story tells us that we, mankind specifically, above and beyond all other living things, is given responsibility for this. It's in the first chapter. Once, as hunters and gatherers, it was sufficient just to be thankful, as indigenous people are today, thankful. When we became farmers, we could live in a delicate balance with the world. But now when we exploit at unimaginable rates every mineral and element we can get our hands on and then wantonly discard what we do not need. Today, we must learn that part of having dominion over the earth is having wise and loving stewardship of it. This I believe. I believe that community is spiritual harmony, connecting each of us, spirits that we are, with each other. Our reading in the bulletin today from Emanuel Swedenborg says that no one can have any life unless joined in community. It's the same as nothing unconnected ever occurs. We sing this harmony together. Now, I think that this concept is really well illustrated in the little story we had in our reading this morning about Jesus and the adulterous woman and the heated mob. The mob is driven by the old paradigm. Everything that is not in harmony must be cast out. But Jesus shows that that can't work. We are all out of key, off pitch. Choir, will you support me on this at some point? Charles, how many people would be up here if any sin of slightly off pitch would get you booted out?
It wouldn't last very long.
Would you be here?
Yeah.
Do you ever wonder what he was writing, apparently distracted, on the ground as the mob besieged him? In Cecil B. DeMille's King of Kings, a 1927 silent feature film, individuals peer over his shoulder, curious about the same thing. What is he writing? And one sees him write, "Thief." And is so startled that he drops his stone and he flees. Another looks over his shoulder and sees him write, "Murderer." And he looks quickly around to see if anyone else has witnessed this before he takes off himself. And a third looks and sees him write, "Adulterer." DeMille recognizes that in this context, the greatest sin in this context is to chastise another for that which for one is equally guilty himself. Before you go to remove the splinter from your brother's eye, first remove the log from your own. Harmony and community do not grow from self-righteousness. Self-righteousness is a quality that puts off so many non-church folk. Harmony and community grow rather from compassion and understanding. We are all fallen angels. We can only ask that God help us pick each other up. Now, that's not to say that anything goes. You cannot walk into a church, pray with people for an hour, and then shoot them for whatever reason. Community requires, yea, community demands that there be justice. Forgiveness is a virtue we all need to learn. It doesn't come naturally. And the people of Charleston evidently have learned it. But without justice, there is no community. There is only anarchy. And community justice means protecting the rights of every individual. The rights to life, to liberty, and to the pursuit of one's own private happiness. And we may thank the divine that we as a nation have upheld these rights in the past few weeks. When I look into myself deeply within and find the Godhead within me, I have to understand that it is not just within me, but within you, and you, and you, all of us. And if it is within all of us, and all that have ever been, or ever will be, it must be much bigger than ourselves, coming through us from a source beyond ourselves. This I believe. And so the divine within me recognizes, welcomes, and celebrates the divine within you. And I bow my head in awe of the divine all around us. Namaste.